Good afternoon. The period following World War II witnessed rapid expansion in the international market for classical records. An introduction of the LP was one motivating factor. Another was American willingness to pump hard currency into the shattered European economy. Europe offered tape recording technology, talented musicians. The eagerness of some American record companies to tap this source led to a number of legal tangles and widespread use of pseudonyms. We'll examine a few of the more significant cases. Mercury Records, known in the 1940s primarily as a pop and jazz label rather than the audiophile Paragon, sought a European source in 1947 to build a classical catalog. Mercury's John Hammond and David Hall struck a deal with the Gramophone National Works Corporation of Czechoslovakia in November of that year. The Czech firm contracted to send Mercury 78 RPM classical matrices in order to manufacture US pressings. In return, the Gramophone Works received royalties as well as a commitment from Mercury to distribute Czech pressings of popular waltzes and polkas. The Czechs offered a tantalizing series of classical recordings in addition to their own Supraphon and Ultraphon productions. The Telefunken Company of Hamburg had stored 78 RPM disc masters in occupied Czechoslovakia during the war. As reported in the Billboard on April 16, 1949, the Czech government, quote, expropriated the disc hoard, with the discs being taken over on a decree of seizure as a reparation of war. The alien property custodian, an allied agency that oversaw such claims, affirmed the Czechs' rights to these Telefunken masters. However, Capitol Records entered into an exclusive agreement with Telefunken in October 1948, as described in Variety. As approved by the Allied military government's joint import-export agency, the pact gave Capitol the right to press and market all past, present, and future discs by Telefunken in the US and South America. These rulings by rival bureaucracies set the stage for conflict between Mercury and Capitol. Capitol filed suit in New York District Court to enjoin Mercury from releasing Telefunken recordings, impound those on hand, and assess appropriate damages. Capitol claimed that Mercury was manufacturing and selling Telefunken recordings without consent of the German firm. Mercury's president, Irving Green, told Variety that since 1948, Capitol had been talking to alien property custodian Brass in an effort to secure the Mercury stuff, but to no avail. Green said Mercury's Czech deal was signed before Capitol's agreement with Telefunken, and that the Czechs had approximately 20,000 masters, far more than Telefunken held at their Hamburg headquarters. The Billboard reported on October 1, 1949, that Judge Sylvester Ryan denied motions by both Capitol and Mercury for a summary judgment. Until this case could come to trial, both labels were free to continue issuing the disputed Telefunken material. For all the posturing by Capitol and Mercury, only three items of note were actually issued in competing versions. One was Mengelberg's 1812 Overture with the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Here's the Mercury 10-inch release of that. And Capitol's competing 10-inch release. One was Stravinsky's Berlin Philharmonic recording of his Jeu de Cartes. And finally, Joseph Keilbert's Schumann IV with the German Philharmonic of Prague. Here's Mercury's 10-inch release of that. Whoops. And here's Capitol's 12-inch release coupled with the First Symphony. Capitol's pressings featured a Capitol Telefunken logo, while Mercury's label stated, "From Czechoslovak Masters." While this case was pending, the Billboard reported another dispute. Mercury complained that their allotment of pressings from the Czech factory included, quote, a large quantity of unsaleable discs, rather than the agreed waltzes and polkas. The Gramophone Works reacted to that claim first by sending a 30-day contract termination notice in August of 1949, then filing a $120,467 damage suit against Mercury for breach of contract in New York. With their check connection severed, Mercury by default ceased issuing Telefunken recordings, regardless of what Capitol did. For the collector, this circumstance does not represent any real loss. In each of the cases where duplicate material was issued, the Capitol remastering from Telefunken Masters is superior. If we could have the first musical example, this is the end of the Schumann Fourth, first in Mercury's version and then spliced into the Capitol version. I'm sure you'll hear the difference. That's the same recording. The ready availability of tape masters from post-war Europe provided Mercury with more opportunities to expand its classical catalog. The company now signed a pact with the Bavarian Radio in February of 1950 to issue tape recordings from that source. This deal was worked out through Bavarian Radio's agent, Herbert Rosen, and provided royalties for each tape used. Several Bavarian Radio tapes were also issued by Vox Records, but no duplication of the Mercury releases resulted. One 1950 Mercury issue featured a recording of Haydn's Symphony No. 104, The London. The performers on this recording were the Bavarian Radio Orchestra, conducted by Alphonse Dressel. This tape was part of the prolific recording activity undertaken by the Munich radio station in Bayreuth in 1944 and 1945 using magnetophone tape equipment developed by the German engineers during the war. Some of these same Bavarian radio tapes also mysteriously appeared on the labels of the Record Corporation of America, including the Royale, Gramophone, Varsity, and Allegro Elite labels. These recordings were labeled with pseudonyms, such as the Schumann Second Symphony on Gramophone, said to be the Berlin Symphony conducted by Herbert Guttann. This recording was actually the Munich Philharmonic under Eugen Pabst, as stated on the Mercury release. Here's Mercury's edition of this, and the gramophone issue. Curiously, in this and several other instances when Mercury material appeared on Royale, the pirated records featured better sound than the Mercury issues. Rather than simply dubbing the Mercury discs, it appeared that Royale had somehow obtained copies of the Bavarian radio tapes via another avenue. The Dressel Haydn 104 issued by Mercury sounded better in its Royale incarnation, disguised as the Berlin Symphony conducted by Carl Liszt. This recording took another bizarre turn in 1975 when a Melodia LP appeared containing the Haydn 104. Here the performers were identified as Wilhelm Furtwängler conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. Doubts about these attributions persisted because no documentation of Furtwängler making such a recording existed. Nevertheless, the Haydn recording later appeared on various labels as a Furtwängler performance. Finally, after Deutsche Grammophon mistakenly issued the Haydn as part of a series of Furtwängler wartime tapes returned from the Soviet Union, the truth emerged. This was not Furtwängler, but the old Dressel recording issued by Mercury in 1950. And the next musical example is the opening of the slow movement, first in Mercury's incarnation, and then followed by the Melodia issue. And there's some peculiar phrasing in this particular section, which makes it absolutely unmistakable they're the same recording. Author of a recent book on Furtwängler recordings attempted to justify the Haydn as a Furtwängler performance by suggesting that Alphonse Dressel is a pseudonym. This odd fancy ignores the fact that Dressel is known to have worked at the Munich radio station and that other recordings by him appeared on the Vox label. This one is of Richard Strauss's Burlesque for piano and orchestra. Since Mercury paid the Bavarian radio royalties for the use of these tapes, there was obviously no incentive for pseudonyms. Other American companies also took advantage of making recordings in Europe. One was Remington, who began to issue classical LPs in 1950. Variety reported in August of that year that Remington's owner, Don Gabor, with Marcel Pravi of Vienna, had organized a 100-piece orchestra to record under music director Hans Wolff and permanent conductor Kurt Wurz. Remington soon released several recordings with the Symphony Orchestra of the Viennese Symphonic Society, conducted mostly by Wurz, but also by H. Arthur Brown, George Singer, Thomas Sherman, and Hans Wolff. I love their covers. After 17 discs appeared using this name, subsequent Remington releases credited the Austrian Symphony Orchestra, and Gabor's full-priced Master Seal label featured the Austria State Symphony on its releases. Gabor obviously regarded these pseudonyms as interchangeable, since recordings first issued under one name often reappeared with another. These pseudonyms all represented the Niederösterreichische Tonkünstler Orchestra, better known as the Vienna Tonkünstler. Hans Herzog wrote in 1959, "The Tonkünstler, almost never using its real name, has made innumerable records for firms such as Remington. It's a second-rate outfit on the whole, but provided with a conductor of the late Fritz Busch's caliber, it can turn out quite a respectable Haydn or Mozart symphony." Herzog noted that the Tonkünstler, at $1 per player per session hour, was the cheapest orchestra to record in Vienna, facilitating Remington's original list price of $1.99 per disc. Many of these Remington recordings...
This is a 10-inch.
Many of Remington's recordings also appeared on their super budget Plymouth label. Here the sleaze acknowledged the orchestra as the Vienna Tonkünstler, but the conductors were anonymous. Here's a Remington issue of the Franck Symphony with Hans Wolff and the Austrian Symphony, and the same recording on Plymouth, the Vienna Tonkünstler conducted by anonymous. Remington's Symphony Orchestra of the Viennese Symphonic Society was pure publicity, since the Tonkünstler was an established group. This orchestra was formed in 1933 as the Wiener Kampfbund Orchestra, modeled after similar ensembles in Nazi Germany. Following the Anschluss in 1938, its name was changed to the NS Wiener Tonkünstler Orchestra. Considering the political cloud over the orchestra's background, Remington's use of pseudonyms was perhaps fortunate. Remington's budget releases inevitably caught the attention of the U.S. music industry. Harold McDonald, general manager of the Philadelphia Orchestra, told the Billboard in 1952 of his concern over disparity between recording rates in the US and Europe. He noted that foreign recordings of the same works done by the Philadelphia Orchestra for Columbia were competing in music stores at dirt cheap prices. In obvious reference to Remington, McDonald groused that, quote, anyone can start a symphony over there. All I'd have to do is go over to Vienna, get a group of musicians together, and call them the Ancient and Honorable Music Society of Vienna, or something like that. McDonald raised the issue of low-priced foreign recordings at an American Federation of Musicians, or AFM, convention. James Petrillo, head of the AFM, was never a friend of the US record companies. The union boss had grudgingly accepted members going abroad to make recordings as long as they sought union permission to do so. However, the growing number of independent labels, many featuring recordings made in Europe for far less cost than was possible in the US, finally prompted Petrillo to action. In early 1952, the AFM denied conductors Andre Kostelanitz, H. Arthur Brown, and Archer Rodzinski permission to make records in Europe. Both Brown and Rodzinski had contracts with Remington. H. Arthur Brown, conductor of the Tulsa Philharmonic, taped 9 works for Remington during 1950 and 1951, including the Pathetique. But this AFM edict ended his recording career. However, Rodzinski, former conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra, New York Philharmonic, and Chicago Symphony, opted to defy Petrillo. Rodzinski had made only 2 records since 1947, a pair of twilight concerts for Columbia, and his career was foundering. He was beginning to suffer health problems, he'd had several cancellations, and his combative reputation led to reluctance by orchestra managers to engage him. He'd also run afoul of Arthur Judson. Rodzinski wired Remington on March 1, 1952, ready to record as per contract, Petrillo, my private affair. From March 6 to 11th, Rodzinski taped Beethoven's First Symphony, the Leonora Overture No. 3, and preludes to Acts 1 and 3 of Lohengrin in Vienna with the Tonkünstler. The New York Times reported the conductor's actions on June 25, 1952, and Petrillo's response was swift. He threatened to fire the conductor from the union. Quote, if Rodzinski makes records with a band in Europe, it means he doesn't make records with a band over here when he could have. Petrillo was ignoring the realities of Rodzinski's situation. Rodzinski replied that he had only made 1 recording, which he rejected on March 10th, quote, whereupon it will not be distributed anywhere in the world. Rodzinski's surviving letter of March 10th actually refers to both the Beethoven works, and a handwritten letter dated the following day rejected the Wagner tapes. You may be able to see that Rodzinski also says he is, quote, at the disposal of the Remington Company as by our contract, presuming he wouldn't reject any further recordings, that is. A Remington spokesman claimed the conductor had approved his Vienna recordings, but they were being held up pending Rodzinski's attempt to renegotiate his contract. The July 31st New York Times noted the arrival at Remington's offices of Rodzinski's Vienna tapes to be processed for the American market. Gabor told the AFM he should not be singled out for making records in Europe, since all the major labels had European recordings in their catalogs, and Remington was paying royalties in accordance with their AFM agreement. Gabor also noted that Remington's contract with Rodzinski included an escape clause to the effect that, quote, if the AFM orders the stoppage of recordings, this agreement shall be terminated. Remington nevertheless managed to salvage something from these sessions without offending the union. In 1953, they issued the Beethoven First Symphony and Leonora Overture No. 3, featuring the Austrian Symphony led by Conductor X. The sleeve contained a fictitious explanation that the conductor could not be identified due to a contractual obligation with another recording company. Rodzinski had no such contract, but despite taking this matter to arbitration, he could not prevent the release of his recordings as the mysterious Conductor X. As a final insult, Remington listed Rodzinski in an advertisement as one of the renowned artists who have made Remington records. Let's hear a bit of this Beethoven first. Industry spokesmen generally agreed that Petrillo's ban against foreign recordings would only hurt AFM conductors. This situation resulted in Pablo Casals' recording of the Schumann Cello Concerto appearing on Columbia with no conductor identified. Eugene Normandy had led the Prague Festival Orchestra but had to remain anonymous because of his AFM membership. European recordings continued to be made for the U.S. market, but now with no gain whatsoever to the union. Rodzinski, who pointed out the folly of this ban in an August 1952 letter to the New York Times, moved to Italy and rejuvenated his career. Rodzinski's Italian concerts, opera productions, and radio broadcasts found favor with critics. His rehabilitation did not escape the record industry. With the AFM no longer an obstacle because of his foreign residence, Westminster Records signed Rodzinski to make records in Vienna. From June 27th to July 11th, 1954, Rodzinski worked at the Concerthaus with the Vienna State Opera Orchestra. These sessions were clearly a test of faith for Westminster, and much of the repertoire was concerto accompaniments. Among the purely symphonic recordings, Rodzinski taped a couple of his specialties, Franck's Symphony in D minor. As I said, I love these jackets. And Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite. He recorded the Swan Lake Suite as a coupling for the latter. These Vienna performances were dynamic, well-executed readings that cemented Rodzinski's relationship with Westminster. However, a sticking point arose when the conductor withheld his approval for the Tchaikovsky tapes. Unlike the union-complicated Remington fiasco, Rodzinski agreed to a compromise. Permitting the release of the record, provided that his name did not appear. Westminster duly issued this Tchaikovsky coupling in 1956 as an anonymous orchestra conducted by one Herbert Williams, whose name does not even appear on the front of the jacket. Although sold as a special $1.98 bargain release, this production included complete annotations and a cover portrait of Margot Fonteyn. Let's hear a bit of the Tchaikovsky. Thank you. In retrospect, Rodzinski's objections are difficult to fathom. The performances of these Tchaikovsky favorites were fully competitive, and the recording upheld Westminster's high-fidelity standards. Rodzinski went on to make numerous fine Westminsters in London with the Royal Philharmonic, including a superb complete Nutcracker in 1956. To all appearances, he got on well with Westminster's producer, Dr. Kurt Liszt, and never again failed to approve a recording for release. Perhaps the most notorious case asserting unauthorized recording release involved the release of a wartime tape of Beethoven's Eroica with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler. Whoops. Well, I've lost it. Oh well. On the Urania label, 1953. This recording was one of several Furtwängler tapes made during the war by the former Reichsrundfunkgesellschaft. And this disputed record, Urania URLP 7095, appeared about the same time that Furtwängler's November 1952 EMI studio recording, also with the Vienna Philharmonic, was released in the US by RCA Victor. The curious aspect of this case is that everybody knows this record was quickly suppressed, except it wasn't. Let's hear a bit of the end of the first movement of the Eroica. Furtwängler's initial action against Urania was a suit in Paris in December 1953. As reported in both the New York Times and the Billboard, the Paris court had ruled on December 19th that Urania must remove the conductor's name from copies of the record distributed in France. The Billboard also noted that the French case, quote, would not affect distribution of the LP in the United States. Therefore, this disc remained in the US catalog. Urania then issued an anonymous version of the recording for the French market in compliance with the Paris court ruling. Furtwängler filed a new complaint in New York Supreme Court in March of 1954, attempting to halt sale of the record in the US. As reported in the Billboard on March 27th, Urania's president, Rudolf Koppel, responded to the conductor's action, quote, "Because the United States and Germany were at war at the time these tapes were made, and Dr. Furtwängler an alien, the recordings could not be registered in any way that entitled him to copyright protection." In Urania's view, the case involved studio tapes made with the view toward their eventual use as records. Urania further claimed that the release of Furtwängler's 1952 studio recording, quote, "impaired or damaged the property or production sold by him in 1944. Therefore, the documents in Urania's counterfiling asked that the RCA Victor version be withdrawn. Urania also maintained that they had legally acquired the disputed tapes. As described in the Billboard, many wartime tapes were in storage at the Berlin radio facility when the city fell in May of 1945. When the Allied powers divided Berlin into four occupation zones, the British and Soviets worked out a trade. The radio station became part of a deal for an airfield.
According to Klaus Lang, the Soviets did not even bother to inventory the Broadcasting House building until 1947 or 48. They undoubtedly had felt that the strategic importance of the station lay in its communication and propaganda potential, not in whatever tapes happened to be stored there. When the Soviet-controlled station moved to East Berlin in 1950, the wartime tapes went along. Urania signed an agreement with the State Broadcasting Committee of the German Democratic Republic in November 1952. The terms were that Urania paid the East Germans $4 for each minute of tape used. Urania also took on responsibility of settling any royalty disputes with the artists involved. The company purchased $100,000 worth of wartime and East German radio post-war material, enough to produce some 500 long-playing records. Urania paid royalties to several artists featured on these tapes, including singers Erna Berger and Hans Hopf, and conductor Arthur Rotter. Furtwängler proved to be another matter, however. Court documents included correspondence with Urania, which showed the conductor had turned down the company's royalty offer since he was under exclusive contract to EMI. Walter Gieseking, described in Variety in April 1954 as a, quote, long-hair pianist, in the meantime, filed another suit against Urania. Gieseking's case was handled by the same law firm that represented Furtwängler and paralleled the conductor's complaint. The records at issue in this instance were Urania 7106 and 7107. The former contained performance of Robert Schumann's Davidsbündler Tänze, and the latter included Bach's English Suite No. 6 and Schumann's Kreisleriana. Both were wartime recordings obtained by Urania from the East German radio. This is the Bach and Schumann disc, and this is the Davidsbündler Tänze. And let's hear an excerpt from the Schumann. This is the 10th of the Davidsbündler Tänze. Gieseking said that he had indeed made these recordings, but for radio broadcast only, not for issue on records. He contended that the unauthorized releases by Urania invaded his right of privacy. He also produced correspondence in which he had refused permission for the company to release records from these tapes, and further stated, as quoted in the billboard, that if unauthorized use is made of such tapes, I shall take all necessary action to protect my interests. That admonition seems clear enough, but Urania obviously felt they had a legal case for ownership of the tapes and proceeded despite the pianist's warning. The suits filed by these artists were the subject of considerable attention in the media at the time, since they involved significant issues such as performers' rights and exclusive contracts. A hint of Cold War tension also pervades the casual prose style of the American trade publications, such as a statement in Variety in April 1954, quote, Furtwängler also alleged that the Urania release stemmed from hot tapes purchased from the Berlin commies. Urania continued to press and sell the Furtwängler Eroica, as evidenced by two particulars. First, following the conductor's death in November 1954, Urania altered the jacket notes to include a memorial tribute. Second, after the company's purchase by the American Sound Corporation in 1956, Urania began to manufacture its own pressings. Their previous pressings were done at either the Columbia or RCA pressing plants. The Eroica, originally pressed by RCA with matrix numbers E3KP 4554 and 5, was remastered under matrix numbers ULP 7095 A and B. In France, meanwhile, 17,600,000 francs in fines were levied against Urania in January of 1956. That's about $50,000. Furtwängler's estate received less than $3,000. And Gieseking, whose US suit asked for $100,000 in damages, got $2,000. The New York cases dragged on in the typical time-consuming manner of civil litigation. Despite the common misperception that Gieseking's records were also quickly suppressed, the Billboard reported in May 1955 that Gieseking's attorneys were still appealing for a temporary injunction to halt their sale over a year after the discs appeared. The Urania Eroica was not deleted from the US catalog until July of 1957, nearly 3 years after Furtwängler's death. The disputed Gieseking Uranias were also dropped from the catalog at that time. The reason for their eventual deletion was revealed in the July 1957 issue of Radio and TV News. Quote, "The astute Hal Neely of American Sound Corporation bought the company and set about ruthlessly culling the catalog of all dead wood. Approximately 50 records disappeared from Urania's catalog by the fall of 1957, including all of their discs involved in disputes. The Urania Eroica has become a high-priced collector's item today, invariably touted as quickly suppressed. However desirable this disc is, quickly suppressed is an invalid term for a record that survived nearly 4 years in the catalog through multiple pressings. This incident serves as a compelling example that demand, not rarity, determines the price for collectibles. The aura of intrigue, along with the fact that the Urania was the first release from this 1944 tape, drives today's market for this record." The Furtwängler Eroica figured in another suit filed in July of 1954. This time, the plaintiff was the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. The Philharmonic charged Urania and Vox Records had issued recorded wartime performances by the orchestra without proper authorization, a similar claim to those of Furtwängler and Gieseking. The Philharmonic also cited Vox and SPA Records for unfair competition based upon their, quote, "using names similar to the Vienna Philharmonic on recordings made by other orchestras." Specifically, Vox issued a number of records using the name Vienna State Philharmonia, and SBA did likewise with the name Vienna Philharmonia Orchestra. The suit listed a total of 42 such recordings. Now here's the missing Eroica. This is the anonymous French issue. And that's the original Urania issue. The other wartime recordings involved in the Vienna Philharmonic suit included, on Vox, Franck's Symphony in D minor from Furtwängler's Vienna Philharmonic Concert of January 28, 1945. Bruckner's Symphony No. 7, conducted by Carl Böhm. Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik and Symphony No. 41 with Böhm. Richard Strauss conducting his Symphonia Domestica, and Johann Strauss' works conducted by Böhm and Clemens Krauss. The Urania issues included the Furtwängler Eroica, Beethoven's Emperor Concerto with Elie Nye, conducted by Böhm, Grieg's Piano Concerto with Friedrich Wührer, also conducted by Böhm, and various other works conducted by Böhm, Hans Pfitzner, and Richard Strauss. Here's the end of the Franck Symphony as issued on Vox. Vienna Philharmonic records were soon withdrawn. One occasionally sees a reference characterizing this Franck Symphony on Vox as another disc that was quickly suppressed. However, it was issued in March of 1952, 2 years before the Vienna Philharmonic suit. Urania again apparently contested the suit, since their Vienna Philharmonic records remained in the catalog. As an indication of how the company's original owners responded to legal action, the Illinois Emperor Concerto from URRS 7-10 was reissued the following year as URLP 7150. It was finally withdrawn when Urania was sold to American Sound. Some pseudonymous performances on the Allegro Royale Gramophone and related labels again derived from the same recordings as those sold to Urania. For instance, the Vera Böhm Vienna Philharmonic performance of the Grieg Piano Concerto appeared earlier on Royale 1264, although identified as pianist Gerhard Stein, with Carl Liszt conducting the Berlin Symphony. The Vienna Philharmonic was obviously not aware of this release. As a result of this suit, Vox ceased using the Vienna State Philharmonia name on its records. Those records were withdrawn, although some were reinstated in the catalog, with the orchestra changed to the Pro Musica Symphony of Vienna. Here's an issue of Friedrich Grossmann's Bruckner Mass No. 3, first as the Vienna State Philharmonia, and then as the Pro Musica. These Vox pseudonyms actually represented the Vienna Symphony. H.C. Robbins Landon reported in Saturday Review in May 1952 that the Vienna Symphony had signed an exclusive contract with Philips. However, this exclusive contract included a provision allowing the orchestra to record for other labels as long as the Vienna Symphony name was not used. Both Vox and SPA took advantage of that provision, but both drew the ire of the Vienna Philharmonic for their chosen pseudonyms. SPA's Vienna Symphony recordings originally credited Vienna Philharmonia Orchestra. Here's the Mahler 6, conducted by F. Charles Adler. After the Vienna Philharmonic named them in that 1954 suit, SPA beat a hasty retreat. Their catalog later featured the same recordings attributed to the Vienna Orchestra. F. Charles Adler reportedly claimed that SPA's records were actually made with the Vienna Philharmonic. However, the commercial court in Vienna had granted an injunction against SPA's Vienna Philharmonia pseudonym in May of 1954, stating that the Vienna Philharmonic had never recorded for them. One might expect that pseudonyms and shady legal maneuvering are by now a thing of the distant past, products of the peculiar circumstances of the early LPA era. However, consider the CD issue of Bruckner's Sixth Symphony on the super cheap Point Classics label. This recording, said to be conducted by one Cesare Cantieri, is actually identical to the Hans Swarovski performance issued by Preludio. This is but one of many such examples that will keep discographers busy well into the next century. I'll take questions, but as I told Steve Smullyan earlier, I'm not a lawyer, so don't ask me of the legal intricacies of these pseudonyms and other. Yes?
David Hall, point of clarification.
Hello, David.
Mercury, early Prescott. Mercury, when it finally got to its Living Presence series,
yes.
Did its pressing with RCA Custom. Prior to that, Mercury had a horrible pressing plant in St. Louis. And most of those awful early Mercury records, though some rather good performances, suffered from horrible pressings.
I'll agree with that. Yes.
I was also going to add that the Ernesac discs were duplicated on Mercury.
There were a few Ernesac titles that I have found duplicated, yes.
Two quick ones. Were the Roginski Lohengrin Preludes ever issued?
They have not been issued, and I do not know if those tapes still exist.
Neither does Richard, I guess. And how did Allegro get away with the Philharmonia Orchestra under Richard Korn? When it was the Hamburg, whatever it was.
If you saw Ernst Lumpa's article on some of the Allegro pseudonymous releases that was printed in the journal, I think a year or two ago. He went into this Philharmonia Orchestra business.
That's joined this year, sorry.
Ah.
Two articles.
There were two articles. The second article did talk about those Hamburg recordings, and apparently the Hamburg Orchestra did have a Philharmonia aspect to its name, although it obviously wasn't the Philharmonia Orchestra of London. Yes?
Those F. Charles Adler records, I actually interviewed the fellow in Saratoga, whose name escapes me now, who produced those records. And he told me that those were done like between midnight and 7 a.m. or something. And it may not have been known to the administration of the orchestra, even though it was self-directed. The orchestra management, which played it, the orchestra chose not to know about it. So it does not appear in the annals, and I have a funny feeling these guys were paid off as the machines were being rolled back onto the trucks at the end of the sessions. Those are the Vienna Philharmonic, but perhaps without some of the first chair players.
I have a book on the business dealings of the Vienna Symphony, which talks about these SPA recordings. I think it's clear that Adler was, shall we say, attempting to promote the SPA recordings as perhaps being something more than what they were. It's interesting what you say about Vienna Orchestra's recording in the middle of the night. A friend of mine, conductor Jonathan Sternberg, whose name you may recall from records made over 45 years ago, recalled an occasion when the Philharmonic played in concert with cellist Maurice Gendron, and then after the concert and probably a late supper, went into the studio to record the Saint-Saëns and Haydn cello concertos with Sternberg conducting between midnight and 5 in the morning. Yes?
I didn't catch you told us what was the decision on the Gisting case in the US court.
Not that I found. And in fact, since the Gieseking records stayed in the catalog just as long as the Furtwängler records, I think we can conclude that his efforts to suppress those were also unsuccessful.